This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Recently, a close friend of mine experienced an unexpected loss. Watching their family struggle emotionally and financially made me stop and think seriously about my own family's future. As the primary provider, I know how important it is to make sure that if anything ever happened to me, my family would still be able to manage. So I realized that without life insurance, my family would be left with overwhelming financial burdens. I looked into coverage before, but the process always felt complicated, got endless forms, phone calls, and medical exams, made everything take weeks. So that's why Ethos stood out to me. Their process is simple and 100% online. There's no medical exam required, just a few health questions, and you get a quote in as little as 10 minutes. In many cases, you can even receive same-day coverage without ever leaving your house. Ethos offers up to $3 million in coverage, with some policies starting as low as $2 a day, billed monthly. It's a trustworthy company that's changing the way people think about life insurance. So protect your family's financial future with life insurance from Ethos. Get your free quote at ethos.com/Brian. That's ethos.com/Brian. Application times may vary. Rates may vary.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, closing out a wild week. If you want to get excited about America 250, we'll give her the details with the person in charge of putting it all together, Monica Crowley from the White House. She's the U.S. Chief of Protocol for the Trump administration. Carly Shimkus is in studio. She's the author of Cooking with Friends, Eat, Drink, and Be Merry. So I'm on the cover of that.
Wow, yes, you are.
Yes, I am the cover.
Throwback.
How many
there?
Years ago was that?
About 2.5.
2.5.
Yeah.
And that was hard on me because you were on maternity leave.
Yep.
And there was a huge gap, so we didn't have the normal chemistry we normally
had. I think we did. I think there's a picture of me feeding you pasta in the book, which is a unique stylistic choice that neither of us were in control of, but we did what the directors were telling us to do.
Right, yeah. And we then dealt with the blowback for the rest of our lives.
Exactly.
Especially if you go to the library, you say you need a cooking book. It's 1-800-1800-CARLY-SHIMKUS.
Right.
All right, so we have a lot to go over last night, including the breaking news. But first things first, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
These defendants came here not to enjoy our lakes, our beautiful summers, or our warm people. They came here because they knew and understood that Minnesota was a place where taxpayer money could be taken with little risk and few consequences.
That is so true, Joe Thompson, as a prosecutor, bigger than anyone thought. Minnesota's Somali scandal blowing up now. And in terms of scandal, I'm talking bilking billions from the coffers, from the American people, from the citizens of Minnesota. The worst is yet to come, my sense.
Number two.
Federal agents breached a storage locker in Salem, New Hampshire, in search of Claudio Neves Valente. We believed shot and killed two Brown University students and an MIT professor. Federal agents found Neves Valente dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
Brown, an MIT killer, found dead in a storage locker, the chase, the killer, and what led to these brutal murders.
Number one.
Next year, you will also see the results of the largest tax cuts in American history. And next spring is projected to be the largest tax refund season of all time.
That is President Trump selling his economy. The economy will make or break the Trump term, too, and there are signs it's beginning to awaken. Will it be in time for the midterms? We'll look at the numbers and the party game plans, you know, because the DNC thinks they're in a really good place, but they've made, I think, one tactical mistake, and the RNC says they're up against it. But if the numbers turn around, we'll see. Can an off-year election tell you about a midterm election? Carly Shimkus, first things first. The president's got a big announcement today. Do we have any idea what that announcement
is? We do not. And Aisha Hassi is on the case. She's in front of the White House right now. She said that she's going to try and figure it out. We don't know what the announcement's going to be, but it's going to happen, I think, at 1 o'clock.
My sense is it's the economy, but also we know things are heating up in Venezuela because none of these sanctioned tankers are going to get in and out. And then yesterday, Maduro sent his Navy to escort some tankers in and out.
Yeah.
So we know that his Navy, what's left of it, would just be and what we got in the region. So as soon as we decide to hit their Navy, things escalate.
Yeah. I wonder if it's going to be economy or that. I feel like if there was something going on in Venezuela, I don't know if it would come in the form of an announcement. I think that would be more immediately tactical on the ground in Venezuela. But there are a lot of questions over the administration's ultimate goal when it comes to what exactly the president wants to do there and the means with which he's doing it.
So I want you to hear. So your sense, I had Jason Riley on yesterday on the Wall Street Journal, and he's kind of down on the economy. And then you read Charles Gasparino today in the New York Post. He said indicators are pretty positive. But the question is, are they going to come in time for the midterms? So you look at the core inflation, 3.1 to 2.7. Now, you're not an economist. I'm not an economist. But just know this. The market loved it. It was up by 400, 500 points because it came in lower than expected. Job numbers in the big picture, higher, a little bit higher than normal. But in the small picture, higher than normal. But in the big picture, historically low. 4.6%.
Yeah. So the number yesterday was supposed to be 3.1%. It came in at 2.7. Great number. Great headline for President Trump. When he goes to North Carolina later today, he's obviously going to focus on that. The backstory is that a lot of people are saying, well, because of the government shutdown, some of the information that we usually use didn't come in. So this picture is murkier than usual, you know, typical. So take it a little bit with a grain of salt. But still, it's a good number that the president could ride this high right now, especially when the focus is on the economy. You know, when it comes to how people feel and what the president is saying when it comes to affordability, I really feel for him because right now he is, and this is 100% fact, what's happening with the economy right now is not his fault. Inflation has gotten better under the Trump year that we just had, but prices are 17% higher than they were because of that 9.1% inflation that took place under President Biden. And those prices just don't go down. So inflation is better. That means that the inflation rate has slowed, but we're still paying those higher prices as a result. And the only way that it goes down, the prices go back down to pre-9.1% is if we enter a deflationary economy. And that is a whole bag of wrong for a lot of other reasons that we don't want to have happen. So, yeah, what does he do? I guess you get wages up
You get wages up and you slow the increase in prices as much as possible.
Which is happening right now.
I believe he's going to make an announcement the more I think about it. Something on housing, because I thought the housing thing was coming up last night, two nights ago in his speech, and it didn't. So maybe that's going to be it, because we know this. If you're in a 3% mortgage and the mortgage rate is 6%, you're not going to move unless it's absolutely an emergency. You have to move because of work. So you wait. But if you can get that down to 5 or 4.5, then suddenly the 3% mortgage, maybe it's 3.3%. You're like, you know what? I'm going to make the move now.
Yeah.
And that's why if you have a new Fed chair who's more apt to do that, which I'm sure that's going to come up in the interview process, that might be the perfect scenario. I want to get to the Brown investigation, but I also want you to hear Larry Kudlow. Not only does Larry know his stuff, he also knows the administration. Cut six.
Last night, he certainly took a major first step to persuade people that there's a Trump economic boom brewing. Over the past 3 months, the CPI is up only 2.1%, and the core, ex food and energy, is only up 1.6%. This doesn't yet reflect the plunge in oil prices from about $100 a barrel at the start of the year to really just about $55 right now. It's incredible. Gasoline prices falling below $3. They're going to continue to fall towards $2. But the power of oil permeates throughout the whole economy, affecting hundreds of sectors. This is drill, baby, drill.
So it's I saw this morning, 282. I don't know. You're in New Jersey. You got a little bit of taxes they put into there.
Well, right? I mean, I live in New York City, so gas is something that I don't have. I haven't driven in like 15 years.
Well, do you talk to your parents?
Yeah, but the typical conversations doesn't start with like, hey, what's a gallon of gas in Long Valley, New Jersey?
Really? That's a weird relationship. Why don't you?
I don't ask.
You don't
that.
Talk about utilities?
Well, you know what? Actually, I did end up talking to my dad a lot about it because utilities in New Jersey were so high. Remember that was a big topic of conversation when Jack Cittarelli was running, and he says that his utility bill increased by double. It went from like $200 to $400.
Oh, don't worry. The new governor's going to freeze it. That'll solve it.
But next time I'll add, Dad, how much did you pay for a gallon of gas?
If you don't mind.
I will.
All right? Enough about my life and my child and my marriage. So let's talk about what happened yesterday. Claudia Manuel Nieves Valente is the accused killer, now killed himself in a storage locker after he first walked into a Brown classroom, room 266, and just started shooting people, killing two, wounding many. Got out. We don't know how he came in. We roughly know how he got out. We know that he could walk in and out. Who would think that a homeless person would be the key to this investigation?
Can you believe that? And it was a homeless person who was living in the building where the shooting took place, which opens up a whole bag of questions over security.
He posts on Reddit. The guy's name is John. He ends up being the person who is the second person of interest that they posted a couple of days ago. They said, we want to know him. We're not saying he did anything, but we see that he interacted with the suspect. And boy, did he. He posted on Reddit that he walked this guy and he asked him, why do you keep walking around here? Your car's over there. And he says, I don't know you. I don't know you from nobody, was the quote throwing at him. Why would he say something like that with such bad English? Maybe because he was born in Portugal, immigrated in here, became a, I guess, a citizen. His visa was naturalized. But this guy, John, spotted this. There was something up with this guy.
Yep. Yeah. So
picked out the car.
John was also a former Brown student. I don't know if we'll ever really fully know him or if he'll ever do an interview, but my take on who he is as a person is probably somebody who's very smart and maybe even too smart for his own good because he went to Brown and now he's being described as homeless. So sometimes that happens. It doesn't translate to real world, but extremely observant because he had several interactions with this guy and knew just something in his gut told him this guy should not be on this campus. And there was something about him that bothered him. So he kept on saying that he told police he was playing like a game of cat and mouse with this guy and then was not at all surprised when he turned out to be the shooter.
So you see him on video, look at him and then run.
Yep.
So I'm thinking to myself, okay, what's he afraid of? What did that guy have? Did the guy have a gun in his hand or something?
Yeah.
But it turns out it seems to be until he speaks, which could be soon. He could be $50,000 richer. Until he speaks, we don't know. But maybe he was just kind of hawking this guy, trying to find out what he was up to. But he was also able to describe the car, a Nissan. And the guy did rotate his plates, put another phony plate over that, but it didn't throw off the investigators. But that happened Saturday at Brown. Monday, he executes an MIT professor, nuclear fusion professor, who he evidently had as a classmate in Portugal.
I mean, the twists and turns and horrors of the story know no ends. And that professor died in front of his family. His wife was there. And man, the fact that this shooter remembered this MIT professor, knew where he lived, tracked him, and was successful in doing all of this is just, it just boggles the mind. One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about have to do with the security cameras. And there's a focus on that for a reason, because there were two security cameras in the building that the shooting took place. They were both on the outside of the building, none on the inside, but there were more than two exits and entrances. And yesterday, during the press conference, the president of the university said, well, I don't think the lack of security cameras really had anything to do with the shooting. Really? How can you be so sure of that? Because this shooter didn't want to get caught. He was using a cell phone that hit his location. He was using credit cards that had a different name. So by all accounts, he wanted to get away with this. So if he went to Brown and saw, oh man, I can't get into this building easily. The door's locked. You need a key. I don't have one. There's security cameras everywhere. There's police stationed inside the building. I mean, I don't want to get caught. Maybe I won't do that. I mean, these are things that the university is going to have to answer for.
So, and I'll add to this. Okay, let's say it didn't stop anyone from coming in. Let's say you got in there. Don't you want a shot, a video of the killer? And maybe there's no Monday execution if there was new what that killer looked like on Saturday. Here's Paul Morrow talking about the homeless situation and what he's found in the past, because he, as you know, he was a former detective. Cut 19.
I'm actually not that surprised that it was a homeless person that stepped up. I'm going to tell you why. Homeless people know everything that's going on in the vicinity of where they've decided to squat. Even if it's a cardboard box outside. You know, when I was on foot patrol, if you buy a homeless guy a Snapple, he'll tell you everything that's going on in your patrol block in 10 minutes. He knows everything. So this guy, he did the thing that homeless people very often do. They're actually proprietary. About, you know, as the saying goes, be it ever so humble, right? And so that's why he says, you know, this guy doesn't belong here. Nobody knows that building like this guy that was living downstairs next to the boiler or something. Shows you how bad the security protocols were. But it does show you just a sort of human dynamic here that he felt something was off. He followed this guy. He scared the guy. The guy ran. But then he came forward, as we know now, and he's the one who allowed the police to button the whole thing up.
How about that? And I mean, he does deserve a lot of praise, and he got it last night. And one of the questions at the press conference is, does he get the award? And the head of the FBI agency that was FBI Boston that was there said, I'm not a part of divvying up that money, but I think he should get a portion of it. There were also, he said, other tips that led to the to finding out this person. I also wonder when he shot himself, if he knew that law enforcement was closing in on him. I hope that's the case. Yeah. I hope that he was scared at the end of his life because he deserves that.
Carly, stay there. When we come back, Minnesota, what this unfolding scandal means to the future of Governor Waltz and other immigrant groups, perhaps. Don't move.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety, built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer is accusing Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and AG Keith Ellison of not cooperating with the committee's investigation into some of the widespread fraud happening there with the social services in the state. Do you think they should cooperate with the committee's investigation, and do you have concerns about what's happening in the state?
James Comer is a joke, an embarrassment, an unserious individual, and a malignant clown.
You talk about classless Keem Jeffries, minority leader who wants to be the next speaker, describing the oversight chair as that because they want to look into a multi-billion-dollar scandal in Minnesota. Carly.
I cannot believe how much money has been wasted, taxpayer money. And it has a fraud scandal of epic proportions and like nothing we've ever seen before. So for him to criticize somebody who's actually looking into this and saying that something's wrong here is just partisan politics at its finest. I mean, he's got no bone, backbone when it comes to this one.
$18 billion in claims paid out by Medicaid in Minnesota, half of which has been known to be fraudulent. 14 programs were likely exploited. One defendant submitted $1.4 million in fraudulent claims using some crypto. The five new defendants join eight others in charge. What do they have in common? All new immigrants from Somalia. Two defendants pocketed $750,000 instead of helping Medicaid recipients find stable housing. We know about the future Feeding the Future program, the autistic program, the assisted living program. They all cashed in, took the money, and many of them sent it right back to Somalia.
So this is these numbers are new, right? Because we originally thought it was $1 billion and we're saying, wow, that's a lot of money. Now we're talking about several billion, and this is brand new information. Is that right?
Yes. Listen to Joe Thompson, the first assistant U.S. attorney in Minnesota. Cut 28.
Minnesotans and taxpayers deserve to know the truth of the fraud. The fraud is not small. It isn't isolated. The magnitude cannot be overstated. What we see in Minnesota is not a handful of bad actors committing crimes. It's a staggering industrial scale fraud.
How does Keith Ellison and Governor Walz and Congresswoman Omar say, I had no idea?
I know.
Does anyone believe that?
Listen, you know what I do believe is that a lot of this had to do with race and identity politics, because one of those fraudulent organizations, I believe it was Feeding the Future, they were asking for so much money all at once that some of the state agencies started to say, I don't know about this. This feels like a lot of requests coming in. Are you sure that all these people need all this money? This is really what's happening on the ground. And they said to the state government there, they said, do you really want to question this? Because if you do, we'll go to the media and say that this, there's a racist situation happening here. And the state agencies backed off. That's how powerful the fear of being accused of racism, even though there's nothing racist about it, is. And I think that has a lot to do with what happened here.
And how about the fact that some politicians are afraid of losing the Somali vote? And they got about 80,000 and growing.
Yeah, that's another big part of it. And now we have Ilhan Omar in Congress, and she represents a whole lot of what's going on.
If you do a thorough investigation, I guarantee you, Carly, you'll be back here in the new year talking about how they knew it was going on all along. Keith Ellen especially. Thank you so much, Carly.
Bye, Brian.
With the holidays coming, that means more gift buying and more deliveries to the front door. It made me think about how I should upgrade my security to keep away the porch pirates and keep my delivery safe. I went with SimpliSafe because it's proactive. Traditional systems react after a break-in. SimpliSafe can help stop a crime before it starts. That's because SimpliSafe keeps your home safe with a double layer of defense. First, you got cameras detecting potential threats. And then live agents confront them while they're still on the outside of your home before they have a chance to do any damage, telling them they're on camera and telling them the police will be dispatched if they do not leave. That's right, if they don't leave. That's why I trust SimpliSafe at my place to help protect my family, keep an eye on the dogs, and watch those deliveries, because real security stops crime before it starts. Right now is such a good time to get SimpliSafe. This month only, get 50% off any new system. Go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Again, that's simplysafe.com/Brian. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We will celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. There could be no more fitting tribute to this epic milestone than to complete the comeback of America that began just 1 year ago. When the world looks at us next year, let them see a nation that is loyal to its citizens, faithful to its workers, confident to its identity, certain to its destiny, and the envy of the entire globe. We are respected again like we have never been respected before.
And now it's time to celebrate year 250. I remember I was in grade school during of 1976 centennial. Everything from ashtrays to light switch covers was 1776. And think about it. People are like, well, we're polarized now. You want to know polarized? Coming up the Watergate scandal, have Gerald Ford as president. Gerald Ford not elected, the first president that didn't go through an election. Coming out of the Vietnam War, ending the draft, trying to rebuild our military in real time with a volunteer draft. So that's the 1970s. You know, I think interest rates for a mortgage were double digits, let alone inflation. And then we had the Jimmy Carter years to look forward to, but still it was nonstop celebration. So it's Monica Crowley's job to make sure it's the same thing, if not better, and will be better this year for 250. She is the U.S. Chief of Protocol and the Trump administration's representative for America 250. Ambassador, welcome.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Great to talk with you.
All right. So there's some things that you announced already, and then we find out about another big announcement from the president today. But on the 31st, the Washington Monument gets a lighting on a New Year's Eve show in the National Mall. In May, One Nation Under God National Prayer Gathering, May 17th. On the 25th, Memorial Day observance at the Arlington Memorial Amphitheater. And then June 11th, FIFA Fan Fest. The 25th, the Great American State Fair on the National Mall. And then Teddy Roosevelt Presidential Library opens up in North Dakota on July 1st. And another big thing, obviously, July 3rd and 4th, the 250th Parade of Tall Ships and International Naval Reviews. So these are just some of the things you've announced already. Not going to be an easy year for you.
Yes. Well, thank you, Brian. Including my day job as Chief of Protocol of the United States, which literally is a full-time job with this president, because I and my team, which is an extraordinary team, we manage all of the diplomatic engagements for the president, the vice president, and the secretary of state. And since January 20th, Brian, we have handled over 150 foreign visits, foreign trips for all three of them. So in addition to all of that, the president has asked me to be his representative for all of the major U.S.-hosted events during his term. That includes America's 250th birthday, which you laid out really well. It also includes the FIFA World Cup, which will take place in the U.S., the final certainly next year. And you'll recall that the president heroically brought the World Cup to the United States back in his first term, and the 2028 Olympic Games in Los Angeles, which seems like forever away, but it's really not, just a couple of years away. So you laid out America 250 and that birthday really well. What we announced yesterday, the president led the charge in making the announcement, and I joined you on Fox and Friends yesterday to talk about it, is Freedom 250. So you can find all the information that you laid out at freedom250.org, and that is a new public-private partnership that is going to lead the way on presidential programming, all of the different events that you just identified. All of that, plus it will serve as the national platform to connect, align, and amplify all of the national community, statewide, local efforts to celebrate America's 250th. So we're bringing everybody together, federal agencies, organizations, businesses, philanthropic causes, individuals, anybody who wants to get involved in celebrating America and our big birthday next year can get involved at freedom250.org.
So Monica, do you, Ambassador, I should say, So when you look at the Patriot Games, I didn't know about this. It's going to be high school, state against state, high school against high school?
Oh, yes. This is going to be a massive nationwide sporting competition for high school athletes, all 50 states, going to be competing in the Patriot Games, going all the way up to a championship where the president of the United States is going to be involved.
So that's going to be fascinating. Now, this is an opportunity, don't you think, and for the nation to come together, because there's nothing controversial about anything. It's we're pulling for the same team, the same country, while recognizing our incredible history. Do you get any sense that in a polarized Washington, Monica, with all your years of experience, that there might be Democrats who say, yeah, make sure I'm a part of this?
Well, you know, I will tell you there is an America 250 Commission that was created about 10 years ago. It's congressionally constituted. Freedom 250 is working in partnership with that commission. That is a bipartisan commission, 50-50 Democrats and Republicans. They have their own programming, which is really civic, community, and service oriented versus what we're doing at Freedom 250, which is more national. It's the presidential kind of programming and the national platform. The Freedom 250 is nonpartisan versus the commission, which is bipartisan, but we're all working together. And I would hope, Brian, that the leaders of the blue states and blue cities like New York and California, Massachusetts, in particular, you know, the Eastern Seaboard states, many of which are blue, but they made up the 13 colonies. I would hope that everybody, every single American, whether you're red or blue, Republican, Democrat, pro-Trump, anti-Trump, whatever your political beliefs are, set them aside for next year, because this is going to be a massive national celebration of our great country and all of the things that make this country exceptional: our freedom, our faith, our fighting spirit, and of course, our people. This is going to be more than a celebration. This is going to be a renewal of sorts, a renewal of pride and patriotism and the pioneering American spirit. So I would hope everybody would get over their transient political opposition or beliefs, set all of that aside for the greater cause of celebrating this exceptional country.
So you got to know and work with Richard Nixon after he was done with the presidency. But do you think I'm characterizing accurately the mood in the country 200 years ago? I mean, it was in fifth or sixth grade. But looking back, I mean, there was much more reasons to be down about the economy, our military, the spirit in the country. And all we had was nonstop celebration. So looking back 200 years to 250, you got to be pleased. I mean, in the big picture, actually, you know, historians got to be saying, wow, America's made so unbelievable progress.
This is such a huge opportunity to unite the country and unify all Americans across every kind of bridge, whether it's racial, political, ethnic, you name it, bring everybody together. And you mentioned 1976. Some of us were very, very, very young during that period of time, right? But we may not remember every little detail about what President Ford did or what was done, but we do remember how we felt. It was this overwhelming, indelible sense of pride in our country, patriotism, having everybody come together. I remember being a little girl down the Jersey Shore, and everybody, like on Long Beach Island, had little flags. Yeah. We all came out for the fireworks and ice cream. The whole community came together, the whole state, the whole country, and really the world helped us celebrate. And what we're trying to do next year through Freedom 250 is create that exact same, but even bigger, sense of unity and pride and patriotism, and as a way of overcoming the divisions that are very serious, just as they were in 1976. But this gives us a once-in-a-generation opportunity to celebrate in a monumental way our great country.
So this is not your only job, as you mentioned. Everyone saw you when they had that meeting when all the European leaders came to visit President Trump on the Ukrainian deal with President Zelensky. You had to greet each and every one of them in that really quick turnaround. Also, in Alaska, you had a chance to, I think, meet Vladimir Putin. What's this been like for you?
Oh, thank you, Brian. You know, everybody said to me when the president nominated me for this job 1 year ago, everybody said, you know, Monica, Chief Protocol of the United States, that is literally the best job in Washington. And I thought, oh, that's nice to hear. But then I thought, oh, Secretary of War is pretty good. Yeah. Secretary of State is pretty good. But now that I've, pardon me, been in the job, I can honestly say,
yeah,
you can hear I'm working around the clock. I can honestly say that it really is the best job in all of Washington. And I am so blessed and honored to have this job, Brian. It is extraordinary to be with the President of the United States by his side in all of these diplomatic engagements with all of these world leaders as he is really making America respected again, demonstrating American strength and power and prestige again on the world stage. It is really such an honor and a blessing, and I'm so grateful to him.
So, and we'll see how this goes. Now the president's going to have a big announcement today. Can you tell us anything about that? Or what is it going to be, an address? Is it going to be a press conference? Do you know?
Well, I never want to get in front of the President of the United States because he has announced that he will be making an announcement this afternoon at, I believe, 1 o'clock. So we will all gather together, Brian, and see what he has to say.
What is it like dealing and seeing the press on a daily basis where some of them so clearly, instead of reporting and maybe after a few drinks finding out who the reporters voted for, you can really see by the tone in their questions, the way, by the way they approach it, they're kind of rooting for him to lose. The ones that just guided by and let Joe Biden just disappear, not answer any questions, a press secretary with no information. Is it tough to see?
Well, you know, the unfairness of it is really tough. I mean, I know life isn't fair. We all know that. But seeing the gross injustice that has been delivered to this president since he first became a political figure in June of 2015, when he came down the escalator, they have dismissed him. They have mocked him. They have attacked him unfairly, lied about him, smeared about him. It is because Donald Trump is an existential threat to their entire system. Whether you're in the press with your whole superstructure of propaganda, he goes right to the American people. And you know what? You may not like what he says or how he says it all the time, but Donald Trump is one of, if not the most honest president we have ever had. You may not like hearing the truth, but he is always going to tell you the truth. And that disturbs their whole ecosystem of propaganda and lies that they have always fed to the American people. It is infuriating, but Donald Trump is the one figure who can surmount all of that. and take his case directly to the American people.
So I'm talking to Ambassador Monica Crowley. And Monica, before I let you go, I don't have to tell anybody that when you're actually working with or for President Trump, you're also in the line of fire. We watch Pete Hegseth get ripped almost every single day. We watch what happened to Michael Flynn, what happened to you when you were nominated, KT McFarland when you were nominated. Was there hesitation about going back into this swamp after what you had to deal with in the first term?
Not for a single second, because I've been with Donald Trump from the beginning. And I talk for a living, Brian, which is why I have this frog in my throat. But I will tell you that I've literally been with him since June of 2015. I have never wavered. I've always believed in him and his message of making America great again, America first, protecting the American worker, bringing manufacturing back, restoring American power and prestige on the world stage. I've been right by his side through thick and thin for 11 years now. So there was never a moment of doubt when he was running again. I knew he was going to run again right after 2020. I said, oh, here we go again in 4 years, because this man never gives up. He never gives up on himself, but he also never gives up on the American people and the country. This is why he's in this to begin with. So no. And when he called me for this job, Brian, I said, absolutely, Mr. President, whatever you would like me to do. And it's such an honor to serve once again.
And the question that blends both presidents that you work for, Nixon and Trump, what did Nixon think of Trump?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was with the president in the White House the other day, and he raised President Nixon with me because he knows that I worked with President Nixon during the last years of his life. I was not born when he was elected, but I worked with him during the last years of his life. And, you know, I was telling President Trump what a good man Richard Nixon was. And guess what? The deep state got him, too. And we're going to find that out, too, because you're going to get the Watergate files that's going to tell the truth about that scandal as well. President Nixon and President Trump raised this with me the other day. He said, you know, Mrs. Nixon saw me on the Donahue show in the late 80s. And Mrs. Nixon told President Nixon, she said, you know, this Donald Trump, he's not just a successful businessman. He has real political talent. And then President Nixon watched the show and he wrote very famously, President Trump, a letter, I believe it was 1988. And he told him point blank, if you choose to seek political office, you will win. So that whole circle from Nixon to Trump, for me personally, Brian, is extraordinary.
And you're doing a great job. And I look forward to 250 like no one else. And because I really appreciate America's history. And if you're saying to yourself, you know, I'm so busy, I never really read about it, start reading about our past, 1775, 1776, what happened in the War of 1812. You realize how close we came to being destroyed and how unlikely it was that we would survive, let alone become the number one country in the world. So then you realize how special it is. Monica Crowley, Ambassador Monica Crowley, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
All right. Listen, we'll be back in just a moment.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete. Not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Really what the president and his team are attempting to do is finally to get Maduro to take the exile deal that's on the table, to resign and move out. It will get you to a country of your, reasonably of your choosing. But that escalation ladder, I think, is going to continue to rise as a result of the determination to remove Maduro from this regime, hopefully voluntarily, but force if necessary.
And that is Jack Keane talking about Maduro and how we're ramping it up. He said land strikes could be next. But right now, the blockade on sanctioned ships, which is about half of the 80 that they have, could be a difference. And yesterday they had the what they called the Venezuelan Navy escort some of the tanker ships into port. Okay. I mean, how long are we going to put up with that? If we want that ship, you really think we're going to bow out or step aside for the Venezuelan Navy, at which time this thing escalates? There's no way Maduro can stay in power. I mean, we are putting all types of pressure. It is costing us money. But as Marco Rubio brought up and says, how come you don't ask us how long we're in the Pacific? When I'm off the, when we're off, the Navy's off the coast of the Persian, the coast of the Persian Gulf, you don't say, well, how much is that? Well, I mean, that's what they do. The Navy's got to keep going. We've got 270, 280 ships. We've got to build more ships, by the way. I mean, I think we're losing China by about 150, and we're so slow in building ships, it's going to be hard to imagine we'd be able to catch up. But we have to at least try. I love the news that came out today also that we're giving Taiwan $11 billion worth of arms, giving 420 HIMARS, I think 200 ATACMS, and we're going to give them howitzers, self-propelled AI-run howitzers. So I think we're letting China know. And China, by the way, barely upset about it. I don't care. I mean, they got to know. It's going to be a porcupine. You think you're going to go take Taiwan, which, by the way, I did not know this, but they have no claim to it. Formosa has always been independent. Japan is bulking up, I think doubling the amount they're spending on defense, and South Korea gets more formidable by the day. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. Find out how to see me on stage in Fort Myers, History, Liberty, and Laughs, streamed on One Nation.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. I'm at 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. We got two big Christmas trees, one at Fox, big tourist attraction. Really came out of nowhere. Now they got music playing, even in the pouring rain. And then they got the Rockefeller Plaza. Rockefeller Center, right by the skating rink, huge spruce. So there is tons of people all around us here. It really feels more like Christmas than any time since the pandemic, before the pandemic. Yuval David is joining us a little bit later, talk about the rise of anti-Semitism in the country. And Josh Krasauer, standing by, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. And, of course, the big decision, the president's got to be making an announcement today, something they say is significant. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
These defendants came here not to enjoy our lakes, our beautiful summers, or our warm people. They came here because they knew and understood that Minnesota was a place where taxpayer money could be taken with little risk and few consequences.
That is so true, Joe Thompson. Bigger than anyone thought. Minnesota's Somali scandal blows up, now in the billions, and worse is yet to come. I guarantee it.
Number two.
Federal agents breached a storage locker in Salem, New Hampshire, in search of Claudio Neves Valente, we believed, shot and killed two Brown University students and an MIT professor. Federal agents found Neves Valente dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
And there it is, Brown, MIT killer found. It's the same guy. He was found dead in a storage locker, and he took his own life. The killer, and what led to these brutal murders.
Number one.
Next year, you will also see the results of the largest tax cuts in American history. And next spring is projected to be the largest tax refund season of all time.
And that'll be big because that extra cash will get people hopefully shopping, buying. The economy will make a break down Trump's term, too. And there are signs it's beginning to awaken. Will it be time for it? Maybe in time for the midterms. Look at the numbers. That's what I'll do. Political party game plan. So I thought it was fascinating that Democrats decided to do an autopsy on what went wrong in 24. Now, we've been over this, but if they're going to pay to have an autopsy, you would think they were going to expose it. Instead, Ken Martin feels, we're not going to do that. Why? Because he said, we're basically on a roll. We learned our lessons. We're winning the off-year elections. Really? You might not like what the Republicans are doing, but there's no indication that Democrats are gaining in popularity. I think you can learn something from an autopsy, but that's just me. Josh Krasauer, welcome.
Hey, Brian, Merry Christmas. And what a holiday surprise from the DNC.
Yeah, why would they do that? So you do an autopsy. Remember Reince Priebus did it. They came out with it after Romney lost. And, you know, even though Donald Trump blew it all up and didn't adhere to it and was successful, they still did it and announced it. Why does Ken Martin not want to do that?
Well, I mean, there are two big reasons. Number one is that it would put out some uncomfortable truths about what happened in 2024. Now, keep in mind, they totally died in this report. They did not commission a report to look at Biden's health, his age, the fact that Democrats were refusing to acknowledge the obvious, which was obviously a major factor in what happened in the 2024 presidential election. So that wasn't even in this report. What would likely have been in this report if it was private, but it's not going to be made public, is the fact that the Democrats went so far to the left on cultural issues, trans, woke, the ideology of immigration, which is obviously still with us in our politics today. But those are the issues that, if you talk to any Democratic strategist worth their salt, they were horrified at how out of touch many of the party leaders and officials were with the average voter. So I think that would have been really looked into, and I probably dealt with in a very clinical way. They're now actually gone to the interesting now, Brian, is like, I think the party tried to moderate at the beginning of the year, but now if you look at the leading candidates and the ones getting all the energy, they are the most progressive left-wing activist types in the party. They actually have it because of, what happens when you have a party in power and they judge the incumbent more than they judge the challenger. Yeah, they've had some wins in Virginia and New Jersey, and they don't feel like it's a good moment to actually deal with the elephant in the room, which is that the party has lost touch with a lot of mainstream voters. So now maybe they can, yeah. I mean, they could succeed in the midterms, because oftentimes the midterms are a referendum on the party in power. But boy, like, looking ahead to the next presidential election, looking at the health of your party, that hasn't changed one whit. And dealing with these uncomfortable realities is an important part of something that they're decided to ignore for now.
So John Favreau, one of President Obama's chief speechwriters, wrote, "Unreal. The DNC's actual position is that if the public knew more about what Democrats got wrong in the last election, it would hurt the party's chances in the next election. How does this rebuild trust between the party insiders, grassroots activists, and organizers? What does the party only trust people with the truth who are part of their insular club? And why on earth would the DNC think that keeping their promise to release the report would create more of a backlash than announcing that they're keeping it a secret?" And it's right.
Yeah, I mean, look, I as a journalist, I think as anyone who's in politics, you want to get the best information, the best facts, the best debate over what went wrong. I mean, that's just good, healthy, good, healthy part of the process. Republicans have done it. Democrats have done it. And I think especially in 2024, when there was such a herd mentality within the party leadership, we have to go with Kamala Harris. First, we're going to cover up Biden's age. Then we're going to unify behind Kamala Harris, both of whom were poor candidates with poor messages, to understand why things went so awry. And we're seeing that same kind of herd mentality, like cover up the problems, not deal with them honestly and candidly in terms of not releasing the report, which was actually much valued earlier in the year. I mean, a lot of it is, I think they just feel like the issues that really led the Democrats to lose badly in 2024 are less relevant now. But trust me, they will be relevant if Mamdani, when he comes into office and governs the way a lot of the left-wing activists in the party want him to. That's going to be a political issue in the New York congressional races. When you have, the fact that you could say things about, immigration that were so toxic to the candidates in swing districts across the country, and you don't learn from that lesson, it's going to have consequences in the midterms, and it's certainly going to have longer term consequences in who the party nominates and who they think can win be most effective in the next presidential election.
No, I hear you. In fact, I want you to continue to talk about Democrats, and we'll pivot to Republicans. But let's talk about what AOC said when was asked. She's polling better. Some fringe poll said that she could beat J.D. Vance. Another more mainstream poll said she'd lose by just a couple of points. And she had fun with it. Cut 38.
Do you think that you could beat J.D. Vance in a head-to-head race for president, as polling suggests, in 2028?
Listen, these polls, like 3 years out, are, they are what they are. But let the record show, I would stomp him. I would stomp him.
Thank you, Congresswoman.
So where do you think she's going with this? Because I think she's got to move. It's not going to be in Congress. She is a member of the fringe, the squad. Even though she tries to distance herself, in my humble opinion, now she doesn't have a lot of the same anger that some members of the squad seem to have. But I think her next move, if I'm giving her career advice, and she might ask me, would be the Senate. And at that time, then if you really have national ambitions, you find your way closer to the center.
So about AOC, I mean, look, she does have natural political talent that many on the left don't have. That is something that, and she's obviously very young. So she's got a long career ahead. I think in terms of the numbers, does she have a better chance of winning the Senate race against Chuck Schumer in 2028 on paper? Sure. The way the energy in the party is going, the way the left appears to be ascendant, and Schumer doesn't seem to he's lost his touch. If he ever, he's really flailing politically in the last year. Yeah, I mean, AOC, I think by the numbers, has a better chance to run for the Senate and perhaps score an upset in a primary. But does she want to be in the Senate? Does she want to? I mean, there's a lot of politics, and making good decisions in politics is about knowing your moment. And if the left is rising and she's got the charisma, she can do that 10-second soundbite on TikTok or whatever. That I think she's probably going to think a little bit bigger. And I do think that her team is very closely thinking about the 2028 presidential election.
Really?
I will say, the Vance AOC poll, I mean, one thing about both of those candidates, they're both very online. And I know, people think social media is real life, but the one weakness that they both have, and I think why maybe someone else may end up emerging, especially on the Democratic side, is that, a lot of people aren't as online as those two. And anyone who can capture sort of the real life people who aren't following every little trend on social media, I think may actually have an advantage. And AOC may be a little too online in terms of how she thinks about the issues. Same with Vance, that they may end up being a little out of touch if they do end up going the presidential route.
We're talking to Josh Krasauer, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. I would just talk about the economy for a second. The president's going to have a big announcement today. I think it's going to be on housing. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we've been hearing. I mean, I thought the speech earlier this week, the primetime address, was going to really focus on like a specific, a lot of the tangible things that this White House will be doing in terms of like building new housing, in terms of alleviating, inflation. By the way, there was a good report this past week on that front. But yeah, I mean, I think that was sort of I didn't quite get what the president was trying to do. It was a more partisan speech than I expected, especially for a primetime address. And I do think that the White House, you look at the polling numbers, there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of concern about the price of goods, the rising cost of certain goods. And I think housing is a big driver of that, too. Younger Americans in particular having trouble getting their starter house, getting their life on track. And that's the kind of situation and challenge that a president can really speak to. But we're not hearing a lot of the details. We're not hearing so much, the policies. So we'll hear what the White House has to say today. But I think you can expect a lot more talk from the White House about affordability, about things that they'll be doing specifically to deal with the challenges.
So here's what Kevin Hassett said. Cut five.
The bottom line is that, when we had the inflationary spike in the previous administration, then one of the things you saw, for example, was the typical home buyer, the president mentioned the number, saw their mortgage payment on an annual basis go up by about $14,000 for the typical home. And so if you didn't make $20,000 more and get a really big raise, then that's really, really making it hard for you to keep your family, keep food on the table and so on. So far this year, we think we've knocked about $2,000 off the price of the mortgage, but that person is still, way underwater compared to where they were when Joe Biden took office. So there is a lot of room for improvement.
So go ahead, your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, look, some of it is basic supply and demand, and there are a lot of ways, sometimes at the local level, where the regulations for building housing are so restrictive in cities and suburban areas that it actually artificially inflates the value of housing. And that's something that goes beyond the interest rates and sort of the economics of the moment. I also, one of the things that Trump is very dead set on is pushing the Fed chair, and he'll be having a say in who the new Fed chair will be in the next year to lower the interest rate. So that may offer some short-term benefit, but it also could raise the prices overall of housing. So there's a lot of important decisions that this White House is going to have to make that are not short-term decisions. These are fundamental decisions on how the White House sees the economy. I know the president is really, focused on lowering interest rates and pushing the Fed to do so, and Hassett may be the next Fed chair in the new year. But those could actually
cause the unintended consequences too if you're too aggressive or too you push too hard. So there's a lot of important economic decisions. We're just getting started. Mm-hmm. The tariffs, I think, have had a big effect too on the price of some goods. A lot of these decisions are going to trickle down, and it's not going to be affected right away, but you'll see that those impacts the long term.
No doubt about it. And by the way, the market's up significantly again. And by the way, because the inflation seems to have dropped, which means the way the economic experts say, if you're concerned about inflation, you raise interest rate to slow down the economy. If you're not concerned about the inflation, you don't worry about bringing down interest rates. We have 4.6 or 4.7% unemployment, still historically low, but a little higher than we're used to. But the president's got to get his approval rating when it comes to the economy up. It's around 39, maybe in some polls even lower. Charles Gasparino writes today that there are signs the economy is adjusting to what the Trump team is doing. He says for business, there's an expansion of small business tax deduction, which is coming, which is going to help. They say consider for working families that they'll be reaping the rewards of the new tax deduction for qualified tips. Working class tax cut, if there was one. And in terms of big business, there'll be soon be an expensing and writing off of more R&D and the cost of creating new factories and improving equipment, even retroactively. These are the type of things that put more money in people's pockets.
Yeah, I mean, look, the White House, the president has said so himself that a lot of the elements of the big, beautiful bill, the extension of the tax cuts, you were talking about the rebates that are going to be coming in for a lot of Americans in the next few years. They're hopeful that is going to create a little bit of optimism from your average voters in terms of seeing the economy in a more favorable light. I think there is one red flag that the White House staff is going to have to be attuned to, which is, you know, there's a lot of concern in the business world about the bubble of AI and whether it's going to be sustainable over the next year or two. There's obviously a lot of growth. It's a big part of why the stock market has been rising and why, you know, a lot of the top stocks, the tech stocks are doing so well. But there is some worry that there could be a little bit of overexuberance on that front, and that could, if there is any kind of slowdown on that space, in the AI space, it could have very outsized consequences. So that, I always, you know, looking for the downside risks in a lot of cases. I think there are reasons to be optimistic. I would look at the AI side of things as a way to be a little bit wary, just given the volatility in that space.
And lastly, I know you're really tapped into what's going on in Israel. Hamas is not putting down their weapons. Israel took out a commander last weekend. Are you concerned about phase two?
Well, we're in this holding pattern where we've talked about this a lot, Brian. The biggest accomplishment of the Trump diplomacy was getting the hostages out and ending the war, getting Hamas to leave the parts of Gaza it still controls requires Israeli military force, and that's now off the table. So there is this, I mean, I've talked to some folks on the ground there in the last couple of days. I mean, there's sort of a reality that there's not much. I mean, we're in a holding pattern. There's not much that can be done. The 20 points, a lot of the principles that Trump laid out are very, very, very spot on, but it takes force, it takes military to achieve some of that. And as long as Hamas is in charge, you're not going to affect change. Right? The focus right now is the part that the Israelis and the allies do control, the yellow zone, is where they're trying to actually make a difference and show some economic progress, because the part that Hamas controls of Gaza, that is, it's a basket case.
Got it. All right, Josh, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Democrats in the minds of the American public are lower than the Dead Sea. What are we talking about here? Well, let's take a look. The net approval rating for Democrats in Congress, you said it, Kate Baldwin, the lowest ever. Look at this. Overall, they are 55 points underwater. Their approval rating is south of 20%. It's even worse when you look at independents. Look at this. Negative 61 points. That means that their approval rating is 61 points lower than their disapproval rating. Quinnipiac has been polling this question for the better part of the 21st century. They have never found Democrats, at least those in Congress, in worse shape than they are right now.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. So that is an over-the-top Harry Enten just pointing out a couple of things. We're focused on Republicans because Donald Trump gave a speech the other night. He's in power, the House, the chaos, the small margin, holding on to the Senate, expanding it, whatever. but very few people are polling what Democrats are doing. Besides not being Republicans, do you see anything positive? American people don't. You just saw on CNN do an unfriendly poll for Democrats, who, by the way, just spent the night before just ripping President Trump on odd things like saying they're not afraid of him anymore or that he was nervous. Bizarre.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And we're also mobilizing federal resources to protect Jewish students and faculty. The faculty is under siege. The students are under siege. When you look at Columbia, you look at Harvard, you look at some of these schools, what's going on. But the faculty on campuses across America and are deporting foreign jihadist sympathizers and terrorist supporters at record levels. We're deporting them. We're not putting them in jails. We're deporting them.
So that's President of the United States talking about taking action, the anti-Semitism raging. You saw it, of course, you see it in the Middle East, but now you see it in Australia. And then you see the horrible events over the weekend. And then there was an arrest of another plot that was being unfolded. So you saw some video of those arrests. But Australia's been slow to this, slow to answer this. And before this was announced yesterday, a high-profile Mamdani appointee resigned after they have some posts were unearthed that revealed her anti-Semitic comments online. And all she had to do was delete her background, knowing that she got this prestigious job with Mamdani, but she didn't think to do that. She apologized, will not be a part of that organization, but she points out that she has Jewish kids. So I guess she married a Jewish guy and hates Jews. Yuval David is a Jewish advocate, political advisor, a fellow at the Middle East Forum, and a content creator and an actor. Yuval, your thoughts about what happened first off in Bondi, and now we have this revelation about Mamdani staffer.
So we are seeing this ever-increasing anti-Semitism. It's a pandemic of Jew hatred that's spreading around the world, and that's been far too normalized. When people attack Jews and say that it's political activism, that is such false moral posturing. Whether you like the Israeli government or specific leaders or actions of a country, it doesn't justify attacking Jewish people. I don't see Americans being attacked anywhere they are because people might or might not like Trump or previous President Biden or Obama. I don't see Chinese. I don't see people not going to Chinese restaurants because of what's happening to the Uyghur Muslims. I don't see anybody standing up against Sudanese because of the actual genocide that is happening, where tens of thousands of Christians are being murdered. Nobody's attacking them, but they feel that it's justified to attack Jews. I've been attacked myself. And regarding Bondi Beach, my friend Tanya, her brother was there, was a first responder, helping people as they were bleeding out. Another friend of mine, Josh, his cousin was the rabbi who was murdered there. Another friend of mine pushed her grandmother under a car to protect her from the bullets that were being fired at people. This hits home so intensely, but these things keep happening. We saw the attack in Manchester on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish year, and the response was horrendous. And even that day and the next day, there were quote-unquote Palestinian protests happening all across the UK. We saw two embassies, Israeli embassy staffers being murdered in our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., outside of the Jewish Museum. These events keep happening. And until more people rise up and recognize that what starts with the Jews doesn't end with the Jews, we need to combat and understand exactly what we're combating. Those are Islamists and jihadists.
Well, and then you have one of the heroes in Australia was a Muslim.
Absolutely.
Who decides he's selling fruit on the side of the road, sees what's happening, sees the gunman shooting right by him. So he blindsides him, tackles him. Yeah. He got shot five times, but he's going to live.
Yeah, and he's a massive hero, and he's being heralded as a hero internationally. Now, Jewish people from around the world started a GoFundMe campaign for him, and last I checked a few days ago, it was well over $1 million, where Jews all of a sudden see that somebody who's non-Jewish stands up for our people, and we don't know how to react other than trying to help and give and support them for doing something that any human being should do. So yes, absolutely, he's a hero, and he should be recognized as such, but we need more citizens to rise up and condemn hatred and evil.
I was just talking about the staffer that just got tossed because of her anti-Semitic postings. We're an idiot. Did anyone background check these people? or is that okay with Mondami? He doesn't care. So what kind of effect? I know people are worried, but are people already moving out of the city, Jewish Americans moving out of the city?
Of course. People aren't moving out of the city because of the weather. They're moving out of the city because they're afraid. They're moving out of the city because they're concerned for themselves, their children, and what life is going to be like here. Less police, more social workers? What is that about? When we see violence happening on the streets, when we see Jews being targeted, there are anti-Jewish, mm-hmm. anti-Israel, anti-Zionist demonstrations happening outside of Jewish synagogues here in the city where Jewish leaders are being targeted. I was speaking at an event last night about PTSD and how to overcome it and using technology and the arts to help. And I had these conversations with so many people who have been New Yorkers their whole lives and so proud to be mm-hmm. here, but are finding themselves saying, well, you know, this is the time to leave. And not just Jews. There are conservatives who are feeling the same thing, who are exhausted by having to have that conversation, or when conversations are shut down in their faces, if they dare say that they watch Fox News or if they work here. I was even speaking to one of your amazing producers who said he's had this conversation so many times where people just don't want to deal with conservatives because they think that the progressives and the Democrats and the liberals are right and anybody who doesn't agree with them is wrong. People want to live happily, and I guess that's why they're leaving the city.
So in terms of Gaza, the phase two, we can't get to phase two because we're not there with phase one. You said a hostage body still has to be returned in Gaza. But let's say that is done because they were in double figures and they're down to one. The Hamas is supposed to, in phase two, disarm, and they're supposed to get out or disarm, and we'll see how that goes. But they're not disarming. They're killing people that are trying to challenge their leadership.
Yeah, and they've been doing this throughout this entire war, yet I don't see protests and demonstrations that are saying free Palestine, that are doing anything for the actual Gazans who are being murdered by Hamas if they don't support Hamas, or if they want democracy, or if they aren't radical Islamists. They're getting murdered in the streets by Hamas. Those are Gazans killing Gazans. So let me ask the question to you. Why would Hamas want to leave when they've attracted worldwide support on streets in major cities and major democracies?
Yeah, I mean, so far, do you think they were sincere in putting an international force in there? Indonesia has committed to it. Jordan's training Palestinians to take over it. Do you see a scenario where an international force there, with Tony Blair and the Peace Council headed up by President Trump and some others, do you think that that might be something that would be not like UNIFIL, which was a disaster in Lebanon? But do you think this international force might work?
Yes, I think an international force would work.
They don't want Turkey in there.
Well, because Turkey is not stable, and Turkey's also supported Islamist and jihadist terrorism around the world. So we need to make sure that there are countries that want to do well that also have a business interest to say, hey, Israel is so very successful in technology, in science, in medicine, mm-hmm. in agriculture. There's something that they can learn and actually capitalize on that. So if they want to do that and create businesses again, like there used to be in Gaza before Hamas took over, then that, I think, is where we can find stability. But we need to recognize that Hamas isn't just a terrorist group and organization. It's an ideology that's been taught in the schools for generations.
But stopping that would be stopping Iran's funding of it, and they're still able to get millions in there or billions in there.
And Brian, I've seen the textbooks. I've seen math books that are given to children in the schools in Gaza. They will count, they'll say, one American infidel plus two American infidels equals, or they'll have one Israeli Zionist dog plus two Israeli. And that's this ideology that's even within the most minor textbooks.
You know, what's interesting is part of the changeover. I was talking to Mike Waltz about this, is changing the curriculum.
Absolutely.
And they are. For example, you know, who's changed their curriculum is Saudi Arabia. And if you're an extremist, you're not allowed in there.
Exactly.
And they changed it. We never thought that was possible 25 years ago.
Well, so how is it that people around the world who are claiming to support Palestinian causes are ignoring the fact that Saudi Arabia has banned the use or the public display of the Palestinian flag? There are Arab countries.
I did not know that.
Yeah, there are Arab countries that are completely against Hamas because they don't support Iran.
Well, Hezbollah was harassing everybody in the region. Hezbollah, when you guys started, when you got took out Nasrallah, when Israel took out Nasrallah and all the other leadership.
An amazing operation.
At the same time, it weakened Hezbollah to go back and fight. That makes Assad, expose Assad, in comes this insurrection. Now, I'm still unsure about the direction of Syria, but we released all sanctions a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
And it looks like this is a government that at least we're dealing with. They kicked out Iran and is telling Russia, your days are numbered. So those are positive things. And they have never said anything, as far as I could tell, anything like we are an enemy of Israel, which is a relief.
It is a relief.
But you still got to worry about who's leading it.
Of course. That's why we need strong leaders. That's why I shifted from being in the Democratic Party to being in the Republican Party, because I recognized that as a proud American, I needed to support anybody who would be a strong leader. We need strong leaders. The Arab mentality doesn't focus on a foreign leader who will want to give you a hug. They respond to strength. It's the peace through strength line that the Trump administration keeps sharing, which is exactly what Israel needs to do, which is exactly what Saudi Arabia has always done within Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. And it's why these countries, part of the Abraham Accords, want to gang up and end the Islamic Republic of Iran and let Iran be the amazing country that it used to be before the Islamic regime took over.
Yeah, we'll see. They seem to be holding on, sadly, but running out of water. Do you believe that?
So in a region that that's another thing, actually, that they could learn from Israel. Israel is the country that recycles the most amount of wastewater. Israel recycles 99% of its wastewater. I mean, everything that goes down a sink, a drain, a toilet, it gets recycled, cleaned and purified and used for agriculture. Mm-hmm. The number two country that recycles water is Spain, which recycles about 13%, if my number is correct, of its wastewater. That's a huge difference. And Israel focuses on desalinization. So this is yet another reason for countries to
Israel
connect with Israel.
Iran.
Could be helping them and say, like, look, we can help you access more water. But why is Iran suffering with water? Mm-hmm. They do get rainfall. They do have mountainous regions. They shouldn't be running out of water.
So the ADL named you a hero against hate. That must have felt great.
I was honored to be recognized by the ADL as a hero against hate. I don't wait for any leader to do what needs to be done. As a true American and Israeli, I'm a dual citizen. I was always raised with the understanding that it is my civic duty to do what is best for my country, to be an activist. That's what led me to ultimately become an advisor to different political organizations. So when the ADL recognized me as such, of course it was an honor. And the ADL continues to do amazing and important work, especially with the statistics that they're sharing, which are horrifying me. Like, what is it? And there were almost 10,000 anti-Jewish incidents in the United States last year. Jews in New York City are 11% of the population, but anti-Jewish attacks against Jews in New York count for more than half of the ethnic and religious-based hate crimes. So we're facing big problems.
And before you go, Yuval, if people want your PTSD AI connection, where do they go?
Absolutely. So there's this great organization I'm involved with called My What If, which uses AI and the arts to help people with PTSD. I also am very involved with an organization called Elem and Natal. What started it is I've survived terrorist attacks when my friends didn't. I have friends and people I cared about who were murdered on October 7th. I've survived sexual assault when I was younger. And all of those traumas didn't define me, but my being a survivor and moving forward defined me. So I want to help anybody who has traumas, who has these difficult things within them, to know that life needs to move forward. It's why I say we should always not fight back, but fight forward.
Got it. Yuval David, thanks so much. Congratulations on everything you do and making a real impact.
Brian, you're amazing. So many people adore who you are, not just because you're brilliant. You truly are. And the way you are on, I don't know, you're always on television, on the radio. You never stop working. But what you do is you make sure that everybody has a seat at the table to have the conversation. You are exactly the type of American I would wish I would see more often. I thank you.
You couldn't have said a nicer thing. Thanks so much. And you can follow him at Yuval David on all social media outlets. Yuval, thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Back in a moment.
The headlines, the stories behind them, and the people who make them. Only on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You know, he did all of this planning. And maybe it wasn't high-level planning. You know, it wasn't nation-state-level planning here. But he did do the recon. He walked the building. He did all of this stuff. He had the plates ready to go. He had the storage location rented ahead of time is how the whole thing went. And so I think he thought that he had outsmarted everybody and that he was going to be able to toy with Brown specifically, with MIT, and probably with society in America at large. I think he had elevated himself to that position. He probably was monitoring a lot of the reporting and getting a kick out of it, but I think he also realized they're closing in on me, and when it was clear to him he wasn't going to get away, he did what he did.
We're talking about the killer, Claudio Manuel Neves Valente from Portugal, emigrated here. Got a visa 2018, went to JFK and picked it up. Got a student visa to come here to the PhD program at Brown. This is what we understand in 2000, 2001, he drops out. Then he says, I'm out for good. And somehow he, when he went to school and majored in physics over in Portugal, he made friends with or knew of a classmate who became a very successful MIT professor. So he killed him on Monday. And that name is Professor Nuno Lorio, who suffered a fatal gunshot wound with his kids, I think, downstairs or upstairs in the same house. He was 59 miles away from Brown, where this guy went into a classroom and started randomly shooting. We think randomly. He went to room 266. We don't know much about what happened in there because of the terrible communication and horrible press conferences run by Rhode Island police and the campus police at Brown. If you have a kid that's got the grades to get into an Ivy League school, don't choose Brown. They're not going to be safe. There's no way these people can keep your kids safe. So choose someplace else. So, and I'm not saying they got to be on camera their whole life, but they got 1,200 cameras, but they have a wide open back door to an old building. And when asked about that building and why would you leave it up? Well, it's an old building. So you can't put cameras on an old building? Well, how does that make any sense? The key to finding this guy, and I'm not judging the investigation, but I'm telling you, the key to finding him was a homeless guy. This homeless guy, his name is John, posted on Reddit that he had a series of encounters with this shady figure who ended up being the killer. He said this guy had a Nissan parked on the side of the road. He kept on getting in and out of the car, walking around. So we walked up to him. And he says, what are you doing? The guy says, I don't know you. I don't know anything from I don't know you from nobody, which shows how good of English he has. And he went back in and they gone back and forth a few times. And John ends up being the hero of this. Then they put out then they looked on Reddit, or someone told them to look on Reddit. They see this exchange that John posted on Reddit. There's a suspicious guy that you really should look into, investigators, because he might be the killer. And then somebody commented, you should contact the cops. Meanwhile, the investigator said they get a description of John, who lives in the basement of the building. They don't know where he is, even though he lives in the basement of the building they're investigating. So John comes forward and goes, that video is me. What do you need? So the homeless guy says, who, by the way, went to Brown, I guess he's got some type of illness that leaves you homeless. I'm not sure the details. We're all going to find that out. He said, yeah, I think it's a Nissan. It was a rented car. I had a few interactions with him. I went back and forth with him. And then when he saw me, he went the other direction. And we see video of him running the other direction. So they were playing cat and mouse. And ends up being the killer. So they track him down and ends up linking him to the MIT professor. They end up tracking him to a storage facility where he killed himself in that storage facility. So he's dead. Where do he live? Miami. That's where we're going to try to recreate his life and find out what he was doing. But it just goes to show you, who would think a guy from Portugal who has good enough grades to be a physics major and qualify for a PhD program at Brown, would end up being an assassin. An assassin killing innocent kids who just want to study for a test. Crazy times, let alone what happened in Sydney, let alone what happened with the Reiner family in Los Angeles. But believe me, it's not all bad. We're just pointing out some of the big stories. There's a lot of good stories, too. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget One Nation, Sunday night, 10 o'clock on Fox News Channel.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest-growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, and I'm right in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. Got a big One Nation coming up on Sunday. We've got Frank Luntz is going to bring us inside and set the table for 2026, the midterm elections, what both parties have to do. I got Kevin O'Leary is going to be with us. And then Craig Carton. Craig Carton is a big-time sports personality, former youth coach himself. There's a subcommittee. It's something that happened on Capitol Hill this week that I'm sure has been overrun by the big events around the world in Australia, the horrible shooting there, as well as what happened at Brown. But they had a meeting with parents are paying for youth sports. And if 70% of the country is paycheck to paycheck, they're probably going in debt to do it. And what can you do from the governmental level? It is getting out of control with the private lessons you got to take and the teams and the travel teams. It has gone up 40. They say the price has gone up 40% since the pandemic ended. This hour, we're going to be joined by Stuart Kaplan. He's going to go inside the investigation, the rundown of the Brown shooter, which also linked to the MIT assassin. And also going to talk to the vice president of policy at the Jewish Institute for National Security of America in light of what happened and is happening around the country. And meanwhile, Shannon Bream is standing by now, anchor of Fox News Sunday, Fox News chief legal analyst. Shannon, what a week we've had.
Oh, my goodness. Where do you even start?
Well, I mean, first off, I guess we start out what happened last night with Brown.
Yeah.
And finding the shooter are the same. I don't know about you, but just before we get into details, I was extremely frustrated about those press conferences. And it's not that a lack of progress, but when you open up and just giving your opinions and talking about the town and, you know, and thanking people, when you have an assassin on the loose and blurry pictures to go on, I just thought it was a toe deafness.
Well, and telling people there was nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
I mean, that obviously was not true for this MIT professor, and who knows where else this suspect may have ended up going. I mean, this is a story I feel like you couldn't even script this as a movie. I mean, the homeless guy living at Brown, who is the guy that cracks the whole case, like, it's just insane. And I agree. I think so many of the local officials just appeared so overwhelmed and, you know, unable to provide relevant information at a time that was a real crisis. I did think last night when this all sort of came together and we were hearing from the local folks, constantly crediting the feds and other agencies that came in to help. I mean, when I can't remember which one of our reporters sent out, there were only two homicides in Providence this entire year. They didn't have a lot of experience, you know, investigating things of this magnitude, but to give the credit to the other agencies that came in to help them, I was glad to see that.
Well, yeah, once, but not over and over again. I don't need to hear from eight people.
Right. I mean, those early pressers were not confidence-inspiring in producing.
So, Shadow, you know what I'm thinking about, too, because we covered this morning. I watched late last night, but couldn't stay up all night for the Boston presser. But they have John. He's the key figure.
Yes.
Who's homeless, who went to Brown, and he's living in the basement. And they realize he's posting on Reddit rather than go to investigators, which is bizarre. Mm-hmm. And number two is they go, we got to find this guy. He's in the building. So they got a post video of a second person of interest, but yet he's actually in the building. So did anyone mention, by the way, that looks like the guy that we let sleep in the basement?
Well, and that's the whole question is, okay, this lack of cameras, the lack of, you know, surveillance, lack of security. There's someone living in this building, and I'm sure he didn't want to come forward because he's worried about getting himself in trouble, maybe losing his place to live, and who knows how long he's been there. But if that doesn't suggest to you that there were real security lapses on Brown's campus, not to mention all the stuff our colleague Paul Morrow has pointed out over, you know, the record of crimes on Brown's campus, at least what was reported over the last few years, it's kind of shocking, and it makes you wonder how much of this was going on, was not being handled properly. I mean, this case, while we may have the man, they believe the suspect in all of this, it raises so many more questions, and questions I think that you should be asking if your kid is on any campus around the country about how it's being monitored and are your kids safe?
Yeah, so I want you to hear from Ted Dox. He's the FBI special agent in charge. Cut 13.
Mr. Clemente was a physics student. Also, we know that the MIT, the victim there, was in that discipline as well. I will tell you that there's multiple phases to an investigation. And so now, in a sense that we know the subject is deceased. Now that investigation continues to find out all of those answers to your question, sir. It is believed that in Lisbon, that those two individuals attended the same university in Portugal.
So this guy walks into his house and just kills him in cold blood, and his family's, he has two little kids, his family's there. Now, immediately, and I'm not being critical of the investigation. I'm critical of the communication. And I don't need to know everything if it's going to hurt your investigation. But you don't have a press conference and they say, well, you have video? Yeah, I'll put it on the website. Excuse me, we're at a press conference. This is, don't come out to the press conference and tell me I'm going to put the video of the would-be assassin on the website. I mean, and then the police chief knew absolutely nothing about anything ever. I watched his one-on-ones. He had no idea what was going on.
Well, and leadership at the school.
Oh.
You know, couldn't tell us what was going on in that classroom, who was there, what the event was. I mean, they're saying things that we already knew out in the media, and you've got, you know, some of the leadership at the school like, oh, I haven't heard that, or I don't know that. I can't answer that. I can't address that. It's like, huh? I mean, it did seem like folks were very much in over their heads. But again, raises to me the bigger questions about, well, how are presidents on other campuses not as esteemed as Brown? Like, how are these other campuses handling that?
Oh, I know. I agree.
Are they aware? I mean, is the leadership or the security? We hear all the time, cameras everywhere. Then you can read a license plate from space and all this kind of stuff. But the best that we had was not really great at the beginning of this case, what was being provided to try to help crack it.
And by the way, an explanation of it's an old building, not good. All right. Ring doorbells can go on any building. You know,
oh, my
anything.
Goodness. Yes.
So Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Secretary Noem, says now, in light of the fact that the killer got a visa, it was admitted to a legal permanent resident at JFK International Airport in 2017. So he was allowed to be here. He got a diversity immigrant visa. He said it was a random lottery. So she says the Brown University shooter entered the U.S. through the Diversity Lottery Immigrant Program and was granted a green card. The heinous individual should never have been allowed in our country. President Trump fought to end this program following the devastating New York City truck ramming by an ISIS terrorist who entered under the same program, the DV1 program, and murdered 8 people. And at President Trump's direction, I am immediately directing the USCIS to pause the DV1 program to ensure no other Americans are harmed by this disastrous issue. I mean, you know, the lottery to come in here does seem kind of bizarre.
Well, it does. And you know, as you guys pointed out on Fox and Friends this morning, the vast majority of people in this country illegally have overstayed visas. So, you know, you got to know when somebody gets an entree into this country, if you're not tracking them and keeping, you know, tabs on them, that's your biggest problem. They're going to stay here. And it's not until something like this happens that we're like, wait a minute, what was the chain of events here that led to this guy getting here and staying here? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're really big problems. Now, I will say with what DHS Secretary Noem announced, you know, and I know that this is almost certainly going to court because there will be a legal challenge saying like, no, you can't shut down the whole program. This is, you know, benefiting people who would never do something like this, obviously. But I don't know that we can even get our arms around the vast problems of this in our country because we don't even know who's here.
And of course, in front of the Supreme Court right now is the birthright citizenship issue. Let's talk about Minnesota real quick. And that is We found out this is a lot worse than anyone thought. Six more people were charged in relation to the fraud in Minnesota's government programs and may cost taxpayers about $9 billion. They've been systematically bilked out of that in state and federal funds when programs that you would think feeding the future, autistic programs for children, you have assisted health care, home care. They just were taking money by the millions and billions. I want you to hear Joe Thompson put it in perspective today. Cut 27.
These defendants came here not to enjoy our lakes, our beautiful summers, our warm people. They came here because they knew and understood that Minnesota was a place where taxpayer money could be taken with little risk and few consequences. Fortunately, through the hard work of the agents, that we have been able to charge them for their role here.
So your thoughts on this?
It just is going to get worse, I think. The more you peel back the layers of this onion, the more people you feel were involved. The fact that allegedly people who were charged with some of this stuff are still getting some kind of payments, some of them. I mean, these government programs are behemoths. We all know once you launch a government program, very hard to scale any of it back. Even things that came in as temporary, quote-unquote, emergencies during COVID and that kind of thing, there was just so much room for corruption without follow-up. And listen, we hear all the time this debate over cutting entitlement programs and those kinds of things. People completely freak out. They keep having this discussion on Capitol Hill about, okay, let's at least cut the waste, fraud, and abuse. And then you'll have people push back and say, well, there's not that much. It's really not going to make a difference. Well, apparently there is that much, at least in some states. And we got to be willing to have that conversation. But there has to be accountability here. And I think a lot of people out there who even know about the story, hearing about it, it's like, no one's going to jail. There's going to be no accountability. Now, there may be because there are dozens of people indicted. But what about leaders of these agencies, of the government entities, who should have had a better grasp on what was going on? There's got to be accountability somewhere.
Like the governor and attorney general.
Who's on your show?
Shannon, who's on your show?
So we're going to have Kevin Hassett to talk about the economy and maybe the next Fed chair, the top economic advisor to the president. We're also going to have Congressman Fitzpatrick, a Republican, Congressman Swazi, a Democrat, to talk about how they're going to fix this major health care implosion that is apparently coming.
Just promise me one question. Get you Democrats to admit that Obamacare is not working. That's why they need these emergency nonsensical fixes.
And it's been interesting to me that that conversation has been happening in Washington. You've gotten some of them to admit, like, okay, the underlying program is a problem. So there are short-term problems. That's the subsidies. The long-term problem is the exploding health care costs. And that shows up in all of our Fox polling this week, too, as number two in concern, only behind inflation. So got to do it. What about you? What can I watch on One
Frank
Nation?
Frank Luntz is going to be on with us, break down and tell us what the midterms are going to be like for both perspectives. Guy Kevin O'Leary on the economy that matters so much. And then we're going to look at payment in sports with Eric, how these parents are affording to keep letting their
kids
up. It is
crazy. Okay, and dance party? I'm going to keep asking every week until it actually happens.
It's not on the schedule, but you never know.
All right, then I'll have to tune in.
All right.
I'll see you Sunday night.
Go get him, Shannon.
Okay, bye.
Go get him and watch in the morning, Shannon Bream, all over. Check your local listings. Stuart Kaplan breaks down where we're at in this investigation, what he expects to find when we find out where this guy lived in Miami. Don't move.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The motive is going to be a lot less specific than a lot of the speculation had it. The commonality between the two crime events seems to be tenuous at best. We may never know. And, you know, unfortunately, in police work, you don't always get a nice, neat resolution. But it looks to me like where we're going to end up is some general gripe against the school, somebody leading a slipping down life. And then there's this professor at MIT who seems to have been everything that this guy perhaps wanted to be and never quite became.
That is Paul Morrow going through the investigation and having great sources to tell us what we now know about this killer directly linked to the MIT assassination of the professor and the random killing at Brown University. Let's go out to Stuart Kaplan, former FBI special agent. Stuart, what surprised you most about the way this all unfolded now that we know so much, but yet there's still questions?
I think, unfortunately, I'm not really surprised by anything. In fact, quite frankly, I think it highlights the deficiencies in that we send our kids to these higher educational learning institutions, an Ivy League college that has, you know, an endowment. It doesn't matter what the number is.
Yeah.
It just, I think, you know, first, Brian, I want to parcel out that in this day and age where there's an escalation and a heightened threat level, we can't be reactive. We need to be proactive. That means that when I send my kids to a school, I want to make sure that the school has the resources and the assets that they're trying to prevent and neutralize something before it happens. Because if it starts to happen or it's happening, we are way too late. And then at that point, all we're doing is trying to triage. And that's exactly what I saw being done by the Brown University president. She's trying to triage and make so many excuses. The reality is, Brian, you need video surveillance cameras that are tied into law enforcement that give real-time intelligence. And for the very reason that Joe Blow on the street, who seems to be, perhaps it doesn't matter, a homeless guy, his curiosity was piqued to the point where he confronted this guy because he sensed that there was something suspicious. If law enforcement had been in the same position to have been watching video camera footage as it's coming in real time, I would assume that police officers would have responded and would have questioned this individual, and that may have neutralized any potential escalation in the threat. But the fact that you have video surveillance cameras that are only there to go back and rewind them and then try to use them as an afterthought is just mind-boggling to me in the age that we are living in with anti-Semitism, the escalation of open borders, and just such a dangerous environment. So my first criticism is academic institutions must have CCTV that gives live stream, real-time intelligence to law enforcement so they can use it as an additional
asset.
Well,
the problem, Stuart. They're going to say, oh, I want my kid to have privacy, and these students want their privacy.
There's no privacy, Brian, quite frankly, for the purpose of going in and out of a classroom or in and out of a building. The reality is when you sign up and are admitted to these academic institutions, you, to a certain extent, give up some of those privacy rights. Now, in your own home, you don't want to have video footage of you coming and going or your neighbors coming and going. That's your own God-given right, and we all are free to live as private as we want. But in these academic institutions or these quasi-public institutions, there are no expectation of privacy. Now, I'm not suggesting that we have cameras outside the bathrooms, but I can't believe that any parent would not 100% be unified to say it is absolutely expected to have video cameras to capture people in and out.
So let me just ask you, just on the investigation itself, think about this. The guy's in the basement of the building where the shooting happens, and they got to be find his postings on Reddit. And he's homeless in the building who went there. They look at Reddit and go, where is this guy? They have to post video of this guy who's actually in the building where the shooting happened. What do you say to that?
I just think it just blows my mind. And Brian, and again, I felt like last night to some extent when I was on some of your colleagues' programs, I was piling on to Brown and even to the local police department. But let me just unpack this. Brian, when the Brown University Police Department responded immediately following the shooting, they realized, obviously, the shooter was no longer on site. And so it begs the question, who the hell were they looking for? There had to have been some sort of physical description of someone. And my question to you is that would have been elicited by eyewitnesses. And it would have been either corroborated or dispelled by video footage that would have captured him coming into the building. And what I find even more troubling, and I said it last night, is my biggest heartbreaking concern will be is if there were not some mistakes that were made early on, which generally has a cascading impact on the progression of investigations, could the second homicide of the professor at MIT, could that have been prevented?
Stuart Kaplan, always great. Thanks so much, sir. Appreciate all your work over the last few days, and hopefully we will need your expertise much more, but sadly we will.
information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
In September, your government recognized a Palestinian state. Your ministers have attacked the Israeli government. Senior ministers refused to visit the sites of the October 7 massacres. And you created a special Islamophobia envoy alongside an anti-Semitism envoy. Have you taken the threat of anti-Semitism seriously? And can you guarantee the safety of Jewish Australians?
Yes, we have taken it seriously. And we've continued to act. We've continued to work with Jewish community leaders.
So that is the Australian Prime Minister, who has not been strong. Maybe now he is. Maybe he's been scared straight. I'm not sure, because there has been subsequent arrests of a would-be terror attack over in Sydney while they still now have memorial services for those who lost their lives, and they try to piece together what really took place last weekend. Blaise Michel, the Vice President for Policy at the Jewish Institute for National Security of America and a leading expert on counterterrorism, which goes throughout, sadly, around the world, you need experts. Blaise, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Appreciate you joining us today. Your reaction about how Australia has handled everything from the shooting and the aftermath.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me on. You know, I think it goes without saying that for 2 years we watched the climate in Australia turn increasingly hostile towards its Jewish community while the government did nothing and, in fact, helped enable it. You know, one of the things that struck me the most was about a year ago, there was a video of Australian nurses and doctors saying that they were allowing Jewish patients to die because they deserved it. That is a sign of a very sick society, and one which requires some sort of intervention, some sort of leadership to tell people that this is not okay. And instead, when the government says Israel might be committing genocide, we need to recognize a Palestinian state, thereby rewarding the attacks of October 7th. I think that normalizes the sort of hate that we saw expressed just a week ago, unfortunately. So everything that we're seeing now, I'm afraid, is too little too late. But hopefully the government of Australia has learned the lesson painfully and is now going to respond seriously, not just to the threat of terrorism in its midst, but to actually fighting this battle of ideas to make sure that Jews can feel safe and aren't harassed and attacked in public spaces of Australia.
You got about 50,000 in Sydney area, over 100,000 overall. Do you think most of them felt secure up until this weekend?
Absolutely not. I think that's the really tragic thing. The Jewish community had been warning the Australian government that there had been a spike in anti-Semitic language and attacks and harassment. According to data that they had released, there had been a quadrupling of anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic acts since October 7th. And the Australian government did not take those reports seriously. They did not do anything to help protect the Jewish community. I think we've heard now that there were only two armed guards at this huge celebration for Hanukkah, the festival of light that turned so tragically dark last weekend. And so, no, it seems very clear that there were very clear warning signs that things were going badly in Australia, and the government did nothing to respond.
So New York City's mayor-elect had to get rid of one of his staffers because, so on our X account, vehemently anti-Semitic phrases and rants. Does that surprise you?
It shocks me that in this day and age we have public servants, public officials who are getting away with saying these things. It is not particularly surprising to me that the mayor-elect, who has said or refused to reject the term globalize the intifada, would want to hire someone like that. And unfortunately, we saw just last weekend what globalize the intifada looks like in Australia.
Blaise, I wanted to bring you to Jonathan Greenblatt, who joined me a couple of days ago to talk about the state of things.
And I think we are all devastated in mourning the 15 people who were gunned down in cold blood in the largest massacre that's ever taken place in Australia, certainly of Jewish people. Dozens more were injured, and this didn't happen in a vacuum. This didn't happen by chance. This attack was planned in cold blood by ISIS-inspired extremists. They gunned down an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor, grandparents. They gunned down a rabbi, a father of five with a three-month-old baby. They gunned down a 10-year-old girl. The only crime these people committed was wanting to celebrate Hanukkah.
And they did it at a beach with only four cops in the region. And it looks like a couple of them were just hiding, even though ultimately one cop did take a bullet and take them down. But it was a Muslim that was the real hero, as he went and thought he was going to die. Just said, I'm just going to go tackle this guy, and grabbed the gun away. And he's from Syria. 2008, he got over to Australia. He loved the country, and he wanted to see the shooting stop. So for people who want to make broad statements that every Muslim hates every Jew, this flies in the face of that, correct, Blaze?
Absolutely. And I think it goes to show that this is not a Jews versus Muslim issue. This is not a question of Islamophobia. This is a question of the culture of life versus the culture of death. And there is a small subset of the world that espouses a culture of death and wants to perpetuate it on the rest of us. And I was really struck in thinking about what happened last weekend. 2 days before that, a week ago, actually, I was sitting in the office of Ambassador Mike Huckabee in Jerusalem. And one thing he said stuck with me. He said, the enemies of Israel are the enemies of America, because the same people who want to kill Jews, the same people who want to wipe Israel off the map, would not stop there. They're going to come after America and Americans, and they're going to come after Western civilization. And I think it's important that we stand up for the culture of life and that we oppose a culture of death wherever it rears its head, whether that's in Australia, whether that's the attacks that happened in Syria against American service members that same day, or whether it's some of the plots that we've seen in the past week in Germany and Los Angeles. It's important that we oppose the violence and oppose the culture of death.
So in particular, you have a huge Jewish population in New York outside Israel. I guess it's the biggest. Do you expect a lot of them to leave when Mamdani comes in, or do you hear about a lot of people deciding to get out?
Look, I think there's a lot of people waiting to see what actually happens. I think there's room for optimism. We have a NYPD commissioner who has been committed to protecting the Jewish community in New York, who is going to remain in place for now. I think there's people who are hoping that the responsibilities of office will maybe moderate Mamdani's urges. But I think there's also a lot of people who are watching very warily and are very concerned about what might happen to their own safety and the culture that he's going to bring in, which seems to suggest that, you know, globalizing the Intifada, harassing Jews, making anti-Semitic statements is going to be normalized and make life more dangerous for Jews, and I'd say for everyone in New York.
Yeah, and lastly, on Gaza, are you optimistic we're going to get to the second phase?
Look, Hamas has repeatedly said that they will not disarm. And I think if there's a lesson of October 7th, is that we should take Hamas at their word. When they said they wanted to destroy Israel, they wanted to destroy Israel, and they certainly tried to do their darndest to do it. So if they're saying they're not going to disarm, I think we have to believe that they're not going to disarm. And then the question becomes, who is going to do it? Who's going to go in there and get rid of these bad guys who've been holding not just 200 Israelis hostage for 2 years, but 2 million Gazans hostage for 20 years? And someone needs to do it. And unfortunately, we're not seeing any of our international partners step up to do that job. And it turns out only Israel is willing to fight for the culture of life. Only Israel is willing to stand up to their enemies and ours.
All right, Blaze, thanks so much. Stay safe.
Thanks for having me on.
You got it. When we come back, we'll open up the phones for the first time. Also, Marco Rubio is giving a State of the Country address at the end of the year, and he's taking all questions. We'll bring back some of that, or I'll sum up some of that. Don't move.
From breaking news to big-name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
There's one place that doesn't cooperate, and it's the illegitimate regime in Venezuela. Not only do they not cooperate with us, they openly cooperate with terrorists and criminal elements. For example, they invite Hezbollah and Iran to operate from their territory. But they also allow the ELN and the FARC dissidents not just to operate from inside of Venezuelan territory, to control Venezuelan territory, unencumbered, unimpeded. On top of that, we know that they are in cahoots with drug trafficking organizations. It's not that they don't, it's not just that they don't work with us against these organizations, okay? It's that they openly, you know, cooperate with these guys and allow them to operate. So these guys are, you know, marching in and out, doing whatever they want from Venezuelan territory. And it's a challenge. And so that's why that's received so much attention.
So that is Secretary of State Marco Rubio, his end of the year, and National Security Advisor Marco Rubio, with his end of the year summary address, meeting with the press. This guy's very comfortable on his feet, understands the intricacies of this story. And in Venezuela, I love what they're doing. You might not love it, and I respect that, but I really love what we're doing. It's like having one of these problems that you can live with, but why bother? Because the ramifications of the infection will eventually be a huge problem. The infection being allowing those groups and countries like China and Russia to, and Iran to run rampant in your backyard. Why would you do that? When you had an election, and the guy lost again and he just stays in power, you look like you're toothless. Even though Joe Biden made the deal, it still looks like the American government is not going to stand up. Now we're at the point where we set up a blockade. Venezuela responded by escorting their tankers in with their Navy. To me, we're looking at a confrontation, absolute confrontation. Unless Maduro is, and he's so dumb to do it, but if he wants to get out, get some money, and be able to live a life somewhere in Turkey or UAE or Russia, this is his time. Because do you know Trump is not going to let this happen? You think that Trump's going to say, okay, if you give me access to your oil wells, I'm okay? Never. Not in a million years. Blew up two more boats yesterday. So Venezuela has got to get it resolved. The other thing, I love that we sold $11 billion worth of weaponry to Taiwan. We started to deliver some of the back orders. That's great. You're talking about 400 HIMARS, 200-plus ATACMS. Then they have howitzers all coming in. Now, can they hold off an invasion from China? Well, enough to maybe let China avoid it. I mean, China hasn't had a conflict since 1979 when they tried to invade Vietnam and teach them a lesson, and Vietnam basically held them off. Now, they got weapons. They train a lot. But do they want to put their whole reputation on the line, knowing that Japan and South Korea are also militant against it? I love that Japan is building up. And again, I love that Germany's building up. Now, if I said that in the 60s, you'd say, oh, that's crazy. But we're not in the 60s anymore. They're our allies. We've been watching their back and it's costing us billions, and we don't want to do it. What I do hope will change is the president on Ukraine has become abundantly clear. You saw the comments from Putin yesterday that he said they prepare for a year of war. Zelensky says, really? I've been spending, I'm sending a delegation to Miami to finish off my side of the peace deal. And you're not pressuring Russia to come to the table? They still have their maximalist demands, which is we really want to make it a colony of Russia. And we want to get rid of Zelensky. And we'll decide who leads. I mean, that's not going to work, especially when you look at the facts. And the facts is, things aren't going nearly as well for Russia. And I don't know if you've seen the video, but we had an underwater drone blow up a sub. They also had a drone blow up a ship. They basically decimated the Russian Navy without a Navy. They have come up with ways to bring down Russian drones. Pretty impressive. Doesn't mean a 8-year-old wasn't killed yesterday playing in the park. Why? Because Russia aimed for civilian targets. They wanted to spirit. The Ukrainian people. By fighting, hitting them directly. And Zelensky knows it because his army, you know, I know there's defections and there's people who are avoiding the draft. That happens everywhere. But I also think that they're fighting in a way that the Russians never expected, and Russia doesn't know how to get out of it. They, you know, they say LBJ couldn't get out of the Vietnam War, tried to figure out a way, didn't want to be the first president to lose a war. So tens of thousands of people died. That's nothing compared to 25,000 that are dying every month in Russian fighters, about a third of that, Ukrainian fighters. But what they're doing is trying to bomb apartment buildings and schools and kill children and kidnap them. Pretty terrible, but we should get used to it. And that's where we're at right now with that. So if you ask me what's going to happen over the break, And I'll be back Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday next week. We've got some specials for you. If you ask me what's going to happen that might bring us back, I think it's Venezuela. And I also think that in Miami, you're going to get the Ukrainians to agree to it and take some tough compromises on land that they should have, but they can't get back. And I think they'll agree to it. And they're going to hand this page over to Russia. Russia's going to go, let me think about it. And then I'm going to go, no, I'm not going to do it. And then the president's going to look terrible. And instead of making Ukraine buy weapons, we should say, by the way, if you don't say yes to this, they're getting 200 Tomahawks. And this is where I agree with Congressman Don Bacon, a vehement anti-MAGA guy. He says, I would send 200 long-range missiles, Tomahawks, and give it to them right away. And say, if you walk away, Russia, these guys got permission to use it. They've been trained on it. Not us, them. And they have quick learners. You know that. They're also helping us up with our drone technology, too. So I know that's not going to get the president reelected. That's going to be the economy. But I think it's really going to matter. And speaking of that, if you look at so many things that could turn around for the president and his administration, it could be housing as interest rates drop. It could be inflation as we get more and more products coming in at a decent rate. And then it could be for small business as we have massive write-offs, especially if you're looking to expand. They'll even do write-offs for years in which you did things to expand during the Biden years. Here's Newt Gingrich for the strategy for the GOP at the midterms. Cut 36.
There's a great opportunity next summer. The president clearly wants to have kind of a brand new, never before midterm convention. Mm. I think if they do it as an online participatory convention where every American can participate in one way or another, and you could literally have millions of people tuning in. You could find ways for people to be sending in ideas. You could do a whole range of things to really have a grassroots up Trumpism rather than a big speech down Trumpism.
So that guy goes saying, was Larry Kudlow. And that is a great idea. But I think the president should have a legitimate convention. Doesn't have to be 3 days. You could make it two. And you have different people speak. You have different presidential contenders out there. And you get people pumped up and a place to go. You know, you just can't wait for, you just can't wait for Charlie Kirk's organization to queue up again. Here's Senator Thune on what he expects and why they're struggling right now. This is what he expects. Cut 33.
I think you're going to see a remarkable 2026. I mean, we're excited about the prospects for the economy. And you look at the things we did and the other things in the one big, beautiful bill, school choice, child care tax credits, the newborn tax credits, or these accounts that are going to be created for people in this country. These are all pro-family initiatives that we think are going to start to yield big dividends.
That's what they're hoping for. If that happens, maybe you can buck history and be the third administration to gain seats or hold the House and Senate in the midterm elections, especially second term, first since Bill Clinton's second term. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget One Nation, Sunday at 10 p.m. Great roster of guests, including Kevin O'Leary on the economy and Craig Carton, Brian Kilmeade Show.